was no going back from the terrible events that had already happened. But that didn't mean it couldn't get worse. That Blaine couldn't make it worse. Daria climbed the rest of the way down, and when she no longer needed her hands to descend, she drew her sword and leaped from rock to rock down the slope of debris. At the bottom, standing in the lake, were the old priest Persantiker and a novice. Beyond them, farther into a wide cavern with water falling from the ceiling, Blaine stood on a raised area, surrounded by four stone tombs. The water level seemed to be rising. Daria's blood flowed cold. Her brother had a stone raised above his head. Blaine, she tried to shout, but her throat was caked with dust, her voice silent. She wasn't sure it would have mattered. He brought the rock down onto one of the sarcophagi. Rock broke and shattered, and several chunks broke away from the stone structure. For a moment, Blaine only looked down, and what he saw was hidden from Daria and the others by the angle. Then he screamed. It was unlike any scream Daria had heard before, pounding inside her head as well as from without, as if it were a voice that had run inside her head to hide, and now sat there, crying out in utter terror. A rush of memories assaulted her, she and Blaine as children, fighting, laughing, sad and happy, hungry, but content. And such a rush of sadness came over her that she dropped to her knees in the lake, the water coming up to her chest. When he screamed again, the whole world began to shake. She felt shock waves through the water, vibrations in the ground, and dust and grit fell from the ceiling. Behind her, the mound of rubble shifted and spread, exposing the crushed bodies of those who had fallen with it, the dead finding light again. Great cracking sounds reverberated around the cavern as faults opened in walls, letting in fresh torrents of water.
Blaine, what are you doing?
The novice shouted.
You told me you wanted to help people, not kill them. You wanted to be a savior.
Blaine backed away from the broken tomb and stood between the four of them, looking up at the ceiling as water washed down over his face. His mouth remained hanging open, ready to scream again. What did he see? Daria wondered. Do I even want to know? Would I? The world seemed to explode in fire and wind, chaos and destruction, and she realized that everything now was coming from Blaine. And as she was drawn to this place unerringly, she knew with certainty what she needed to do. Daria closed her hand around her sword and started forward. It's me, Blaine thought, and he looked down at the body of a god. If anything remained inside these sealed tombs, he'd assumed it would be little more than a shred of dried flesh, a shard of bone. So ancient now, who or whatever the gods had actually been would have rotted away to nothing, and then crumbled to dust. It's just like me. The face looking up at him was not his own, but it was so like him that Blaine could not tell the difference. Bajumin skin, pale and cool in death. Bajumin eyes open and staring at nothing for all eternity. Their deep blue as endless as the day this being had died. Uncorrupted in death. Frozen in a moment. The terror that clashed teeth together over Blaine's heart was from the sudden understanding of just how much magic he didn't have. His own power was a mere morsel of what these gods possessed. The potential in them was dreadful. The dead god did not move its head, but its eyes turned in its skull, fixing on Blaine with an icy regard, awake, somehow, aware of him. Stumbling back, another scream locked forever in his chest, he looked to the ceiling and felt water flowing across his face, and deeper down he felt the power rushing into him, power and a joy unimagined. Were these the secrets from the missing panels of the Covenant of the Four? That the gods were Bajumin?
Blaine laughed so hard tears streamed from his eyes. The blood of the four flowed in the veins of the royals, which meant they'd been part Bajamin all along, somewhere back along the bloodline. This was why the priesthood had always kept magic away from the monarchs of Qandis. Out of fear. But what they ought to have feared all along was something more than a queen or a king. They ought to have feared a pure Bajuman. They ought to have feared the Kijtal. I am the true heir of the four. The only suitable vessel for the reemergence. Not Lysandra or Fila, foolish pretenders. Not the High Order, dabblers in power they had not even begun to understand. Me. The magic flooded into him, and he felt himself open to receive it. Felt it crack him wide and overflow the vessel of his poor flesh. It spilled out and spent itself in the world, and Blaine knew, saw, and felt everything that was happening. From Ansalam, great quakes shook the whole of Temple Hill and beyond, shaking buildings to the ground and opening rents in the land, into which people and history fell, and out of which shadows crawled. From Betika came the storms, sweeping waves down the river to flood boats and drown people, unleashing winds that flattened neighborhoods and swept away centuries of construction. Charin brought fire, flaming molten rock bursting from the top of Calistrade Hill, in a massive explosion that dropped blazing magma across Lartha and beyond. Firestorms raged as wind streaked along alleys and streets. Superheated air turned rain to scalding steam that stripped flesh from bone. And finally Daphine surged along the river and to the sea beyond, raising tidal waves that washed away fishing ports and coastal dwellings, powering back inland and wiping out 100 square miles of farming land and farms. Qandis cracked and burned. Death traveled on the wind, and water drowned the screams of the dying. Blaine swallowed the magic because it was everything he had always wanted. And when he at last opened his eyes again and looked down, Daria was climbing up between the tombs. She stared right at him, never blinking, and never once looking aside at the thing he had seen. The terror in her was plain. "Sister," he said, holding out his hands. She must know what this meant. She would see the magic in him, making him whole and beautiful now, instead of making him bleed. And she would revel in it as much as him. He would save their people. And she would be by his side as he did so. "Daria," he said, "it was me all along, the Kijtal." Her left hand held his right hand, and she pulled him close. For a hug, he thought, for an embrace. She felt safe because she knew that she would be the first Bajuman he saved. At first he thought she had punched him. He frowned, looked down, saw her hand pressing against his chest over his heart. Then he felt the pain, and saw the blood, and every aspect of his new, wonderful magic shrieked at what she had done. Daria was blown back and away from Blaine by a spurt of water and fire. A blast of wind and a ragged detonation, all issuing from the wound she had made in his chest, all carried in his rich arterial blood. Her knife had pierced her brother's heart, and his blood was thick on her hand. She still grasped the blade. As she flew back through the air, she could see him, slumping down between the tombs and trying to hold the fluid that spurted out between his fingers. She was already crying when she struck the surface of the water and went under. When she surfaced again, the whole world was falling apart. Stone walls cracked and fell, and river water poured in. Hands grabbed her arms and pulled her back toward the mound of rubble and the tunnels beyond.
a priest and a novice dragging her away from her dying brother. And she let them. She struggled to stand and look back at Blaine. And the last time she saw him, he was kneeling between the tombs of the four, blood pulsing from the wound with ever-weakening beats of his heart. She felt the pain in her own heart, and it was an agony she knew would follow her into death. Blaine saw his sister across the cavern, Jemmy trying to pull her away, and he tried to ask her what she had done, to ask why, but he had no voice. His heart was stuttering. His blood was cooling. He looked across at the god that had turned its eyes upon him, and its body was now old and decayed, its eyes shriveled back into the pits in its skull. As his heart beat its last, a wall of water surged across the cavern and plucked Blaine away, smashing him from the tombs and sweeping him into a deep, eternal darkness. Chapter 24. Dawn broke over Lartha with its usual languid beauty, a brightening of the indigo horizon that spread golden light and morning shadows across the city, as if nothing at all had occurred the day before, as if somehow the world cared not at all what had transpired there. Daria watched the glimmer of morning grow, and the sky brightened to blue. The rains had stopped, the clouds cleared, and it looked like a fine, growing season day. It would have been perfectly cloudless were it not for the plumes of smoke still rising from the fires that had burned through most of the night. She'd managed only a few hours of sleep in the small hours, and returned to the deck of the Nyadine while the night watch still walked the deck. All through the darkness, little boats had passed the fleet, headed downriver towards Suskmith, and perhaps out to the ring beyond. People who'd lost their homes or who were too frightened to stay, terrified that the ground might begin to shake anew, or that the battle for the crown would continue. Perhaps their homes still stood, but had sustained enough damage that they were now unsafe, uninhabitable. Perhaps they were haunted by Fila's horrors, or by the friends and family who died there. Either way, Lartha was emptying. The fleet allowed these boats to pass, but her sailors and fighters had watched each of them closely, wary of some final attack by those loyal to Queen Fila. It did not surprise Daria to learn, in the pre-dawn hour, that her ships had not encountered anyone who still wished to fight for Fila. The knowledge might have given her hope, except that she could now stand at the railing of her flagship and watch as morning arrived, and finally see the true toll that Fila's brief reign had taken on the city. There would come a time when she might weep, a time when the tears might fall no matter how hard she tried to fight them. But this morning she felt hollowed out and numb, even further away from tears than she was from laughter. The city that lay just upriver, beyond the tumble of stone that had once been the outer wall, was unrecognizable to her. How could this be Lartha? Where there had been 7 hills, there were now 6. Hartshorn Hill had shaken itself apart. The ground had opened and swallowed it, doubtless ending thousands of lives. Of the others, only Clan Docklin seemed relatively unscathed. The other hills bore terrible scars. Whole neighborhoods had burned or been destroyed by the quaking of the earth. Atop Temple Hill, only the Tower of Batika still stood, and she sensed the irony. If any of the four had won the day before, it was Batika, the god of wind and war. Then, of course, there was Palace Hill. The blood spire had cracked in half, the upper portion had toppled, but a jagged remainder was a brutal slash against the horizon, a murder weapon. The bone spire was gone completely. One whole wing of the palace had collapsed, taking the archives of the crown with it. Yet miraculously, much of the structure remained intact. With great care, patience, and time, the palace could be rebuilt. Whether or not that ought to be considered a good thing, Daria couldn't be sure. A footfall on the deck alerted her that she was no longer alone at the railing. Daria glanced to her right and saw Princess Mirren. Tired as she looked, the woman radiated a strange sense of calm. Tall and strong, bruised and unkempt, she looked far more like a warrior than a royal. For so long, Daria had wondered at the bond between Deimos and a princess. But this morning, she wondered no more. "Majesty," Daria said. Mirren inclined her head. "Admiral." They stood together at the railing, surveying the still-smoking city. From somewhere very far off came the sound of a hammer, though only minutes after sunrise, someone had already begun to rebuild. "It's so..." Princess Mirren began before losing her way. "Horrifying, yes. Though I was going to say it's so quiet. I've never known the city so quiet." The hammer rang out again, the sound traveling quite a distance to reach them. "Yes. Quiet," Daria agreed. "But not silent. The night seemed far too long, Majesty. But Quandus wakes now, and we're still here to greet it." Princess Mirren gave her a thoughtful glance. "You know, Admiral, I think we're going to get along very well." "Oh, I doubt it." Mirren frowned. "Pardon me?" Daria met her gaze. "I've just helped you usurp your mad sister. You seem honorable enough, Princess, and I've a deep respect for your husband-to-be. But I was born the lowest of slaves, and you, as a pinnacle of royalty, were the owner of us all. Yesterday I fought for Quandus. All of Quandus, not just the crown. I intend to spend my life doing the same." "As did I," Mirren said. "As will I." "I shall hold you to that promise," Daria warned. "See that you do." Daria nodded slowly. They understood each other. And maybe Mirren's wish that they could get along might eventually happen. But it wouldn't be today. And probably not tomorrow. Together, the two women gazed out over the city, and the new day began. They had no throne on board the Naya Deen, so a chair from the Admiral's quarters had been brought up on deck and deemed satisfactory. Deimos had smiled at Mirren's use of the word. Anything would have been satisfactory at this point. Any intact chair, a folding stool, or an upturned barrel. That was one of the things he loved about the woman he'd promised to marry. The entire kingdom had been thrown into turmoil. Thousands of people had been killed. The capital city practically decimated. She had no time for the niceties of monarchy. Mirren was going to make an exceptional queen, and it broke his heart. A lieutenant from the Breath of Tikra played the violin as the fleet's officers gathered on the deck of the Naya Deen. Deimos stood at attention with them, watching as Mirren emerged from below decks. With no access to her own clothes, she had cobbled together a selection of clothing from various sources among the fleet. Clean shirt and trousers, crisply pressed, and close enough to fitting her that nobody would notice. Nothing ornamental save for the ceremonial scabbard that hung at her hip. The sword within it had been the one she'd used in battle yesterday, and she'd vowed to Deimos that it would be the one she carried for the rest of her days. He'd wondered if she might be the first monarch of Quandus to wear a sword to her coronation. Mirren had gone quiet a moment before confessing the certainty that she would not be the last. She wore the wine-red cloak of a healer. That and the sword would be what people remembered about this moment. Both had weight and symbolism that would resonate for eons. On this day, in this place, The future queen had made an unspoken promise to defend and to heal Qandis and its people. It had beauty and simplicity, much like Mirin's wardrobe choices, and like the thick braid into which she'd tied her hair. This, anyone watching her would think, this was a leader. With every step she took across the deck, Deimos felt her moving further away from him. The slave brand burned into his right hand was visible to everyone. He wondered how a queen could marry a man with such a brand. But every time he glanced at Daria, this Bajamin woman who'd become the true hero of the battle for Lartha, he realized that perhaps the old scars and brands had lost their meaning. It was a sliver of hope he held on to with all his strength. The violin played. Officers stiffened their spines, trying to give the proceedings as much dignity as possible. Even the injured seemed to forget their wounds in that moment, watching Mirin stride toward the black wood and red velvet chair. All whispers stopped. Even the creaking of the ship's timbers and the rushing burble of the river went quiet. Only the violin broke the silence as Mirin turned and took her seat. A priest named Perjoli, not high order, but a woman who'd traveled with the fleet and had conducted weekly services on board the Royal Dawn, approached and knelt before the princess. Mirin gestured for her to stand, and the priest rose, then moved around behind the makeshift throne. Perjoli extended her hands, palms toward the sky, and began to pray over Mirin. Deimos found himself wincing as the priest intoned the names of the four. A restless shuffling occurred among those gathered there, and many glanced uneasily toward the devastated city, where even now uncounted thousands needed their help and the help of the gods. But it had been the power of those selfsame gods that had laid waste to Lartha. It was no wonder so many seemed unsettled by the idea of seeking their blessings now. The prayer ended. Deimos had barely heard the words. The wind gusted across the bow, and the rigging clanked against the masts overhead. The Nyadin bobbed in the river, and the entire assemblage seemed to hold its breath. Deimos scanned those gathered faces, many familiar, and others not. He saw Thistle. The man tipped him a wink, and Deimos couldn't help smiling. A good man, Thistle. He saw Daphna Greece, who served faithfully as the voice of the queen, despite her fear of Phila, and who had stumbled through the ruins last night with a handful of other royal servants to pledge their fealty to Mirin. So many good people here, a strong foundation for the future. He saw the young novice Jemmy, who had helped Daria on the long climb out from the tombs and into the ruin of the temple. They had lost old Persantigar on that climb, a broken and wounded man. It had been another sad loss. The wide ranks of the faith had been decimated, but they would rebuild. Novices like Jemmy would be the beginning. Daria had brought her on board because Jemmy had been a friend to Blaine. Perhaps it eased her grief, Deimos thought, to have someone close by who knew him better than his own sister had. He understood, and he thought Mirin would as well. All three of them were orphans now. Himself, Daria, and Mirin. No parents. No siblings. At least you've got family left, Deimos told himself. His gaze shifted into the distance where Calistrate Hill still stood. Ravaged but still strong. All he had to do was to walk to the top of that hill and he would take up his father's mantle. Slave brand or no slave brand, he would be Baron Calistrate if he wanted it. If he wanted it. Perjoli gestured toward the line of officers, and they parted to allow a small figure to come forward. Deimos smiled again, and some of the darkness lifted from his heart. As he saw Tolliver approach the priest with a pillow whose velvet matched the coronation chair. Upon the pillow rested the true crown that they had rescued from the archives. Again the assemblage seemed to quiet, to stand a bit taller in the presence of what that crown represented. Tradition. History. The blood of the four. The strength of the values the kingdom had shared before Lysandra had tasted magic and Spiza. Before Fila's ambitions had tainted all that Qandis stood for. Today, Deimos thought. Today it's tainted. But maybe not tomorrow. He stared at Mirren, watching her eyes as Per Joli took the crown from Tolliver's pillow and raised it above her head. All he had ever wanted was a quiet life with this strong and beautiful woman, a life of children and laughter, away from the duties of the crown. Those were meant for Aris, or even for Fila, but not Mirren. It had all seemed so simple. So joyful when they were children and later when they were young and falling in love. As he watched Per Joli lower the crown, saw it touch Mirren's hair. Deimos closed his eyes, unable to watch the moment when the road back to a simpler time was blocked off to them forever. The violin went quiet, leaving only the wind and the creak of the ship and the hush of the river. Deimos opened his eyes. Beneath the gaze of the four who bless us, Per Joli said, we see this woman with our own eyes. Mirren of the blood of the four, crowned queen of Qandis. Mirren, commander of the five armies. Mirren, queen of strikes, honorary beneficent leader of larks, figure of nine and lady of fields. Queen Mirren, the sword of Lartha. Daria stepped forward, stiff and formal. Chin raised, she marched along the ranks of her officers and stopped before the coronation chair. A smile touched her lips. Queen Mirren, sword of Lartha, Daria echoed. Admiral Halardi, Mirren replied with a nod. Daria drew her sword. Knelt, and placed it at the feet of the queen. Deimos's feet were moving before he'd even realized they might. Three steps in, and he wished he had stayed put. All eyes were on him as he broke every tradition, interrupted the ritual, drawing his sword as he approached. Several of the officers took half a step as if to stop him, perhaps fearful that he meant to harm the newly crowned queen. He made sure to stay two steps farther back than the admiral. She outranked him, after all. Queen Mirren, Deimos said, his heart lightening as the words left his lips. His love stared at him, and when he grinned, it seemed to surprise them both. Sword of Lartha. Just as the admiral had done, he laid down his sword and knelt before the queen. Life would never be simple again, would never be the quiet joy that he'd dreamed of. But Mirren was his queen now, and as he pledged himself anew, all his regrets seemed to fade. One by one, the other officers on deck followed his example, laying down their swords and kneeling to Queen Mirren. Daphna did not kneel. From the corner of his eye, Deimos saw her make her way through the officers and come up to stand beside Tolliver. Your Majesty, Daphna said, I served both your mother and your sister. If you will have me, it would be my honor to serve you now as voice of the queen. Mirren stood, the rough-hewn crown glinting in the sun, her sword hanging by her side, healer's cloak rustling in the wind that swept across the deck. You have my thanks, old friend, Queen Mirren said. But I will speak for myself. Deimos smiled, still kneeling, until she commanded them all to rise. As one, those who had offered their swords stood and faced their queen. The city is shattered, Queen Mirren said, gazing out over the hushed congregation. Behind her in the distance, Black smoke still rose from the dying fires in Lartha. Hills have fallen. Noble houses lie in ruins. The priesthood is diminished. And though we all now recognize the truth of magic, its power and its poison, its influence will wane with the unraveling of its mysteries. All that has been in the shadow of secrecy shall be exposed to the light. It will take generations to recover from this. But over those generations, we will not merely build a new city. We will build a new people. A new society in which service to the crown and to our fellows will one day be honored in equal measure, and in which that service is offered by duty or fealty or out of necessity, but never in chains, never in slavery. From this day forward, let the brands on the flesh of all former slaves be a reminder that each of us is entitled to fight for our own future, our own freedom. Deimos felt his heart swell. No matter how eloquent she was, Mirren's words alone could not erase his shame or the urge to cover the slave brand on his hand. But he felt a deep determination now to combat that shame. What had marked him as a slave, no matter how briefly, would now be a sigil, a symbol of freedom and resistance. He made a silent vow to inspire other former slaves, those who knew nothing of freedom, who'd experienced only the worst of society, to feel the same. "Yes, the city is shattered," Mirren continued. Her eyes shone brightly, alight with purpose. "Many have died. Institutions have crumbled along with architecture. But we have built hills and bridges before, and we will do so again. The city is scarred and broken. But my friends, the nation is strong. Quandis is strong. Quandis endures. Quandis is triumphant." She drew her sword and raised it over her head, its edge gleaming in the sun. Deimos cried out, echoing her words. Other voices joined them, rising in chorus. "Quandis endures. Quandis is triumphant." Only a day before he had intended to leave her, and now he knew he never would, never could. It occurred to him that he wasn't sure which her his thoughts referred to, Mirren, or Quandis itself. But it didn't matter, really. For in the end, they were one and the same, and both had his love. Both had his vow and his sword, forever. "Quandis endures," he cried, and Quandis was triumphant. This is Christine Vam. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Blood of the Four by Christopher Golden and Tim Levin. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Katie Ostroka. Copyright 2018 by Daring Greatly Corporation and Tim Levin. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.